for being here. I appreciate you joining the program this evening. I just put the link for the source sheet in the chat once again. This is the second of our programs for the Shavuot Tone on Lessons in Reinvention from Rabbi Akiva. Our topic tonight is From Pauper to Anti-Welfare Crusader. And I hope this is going to be an interesting program. I thank the Bayit as well as Shari Shamayim for co-sponsoring the program with us. Just a note, if anybody who's here isn't getting our emails from the Beit Midrash for advertising upcoming programs, and to send me an email or put a note to me in the chat, that would be great. I'm only recording audio. I'm not recording video. And my primary reason for that is because I want to encourage people to have their screens on. I always enjoy a shiur a lot more if I can see people. It helps me, feel like I'm not talking to a screen. So hopefully people will feel comfortable doing that. If you're eating dinner, that's fine. Hopefully we're having a little matzah for Pesach Sheni. And that will be great. Also, one note for those who are not regulars at my classes, I much prefer that if you have a question, a comment, you put it out there verbally as opposed to writing it to me in the chat. It's one less thing for me to monitor. So that's my preference if it works for you. Okay, so our topic, as I said, is Rabbi Akiva, From Pauper to Anti-Welfare Crusader. I want you to take a look, please, at the source sheet that I've been sharing in the chat. At source number one, this is a Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah. It has a sister Gemara that's very close to it, but the Medrash is the one that mentions Rabbi Akiva's name, and that's why that's the one I'm using, in which Rabbi Acha says something based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, a verse in Isaiah. And I see Rabbi Strauchli here. Thank you very much for joining and for co-sponsoring the program. Rabbi Acha is commenting on a verse in the first sentence, in the first chapter in Yeshaya. And he says, Tzrichim Yisrael lacharuva avdun tesuva. When the Jews need caribs, in order to survive, when they have to survive on Buxer, right? For those who remember the days when the Women's League or the PTA would provide Buxer in the schools for Tu B'Shvat. You know what I'm talking about. You know what Rabbi Acha is talking about. When Israel needs to subsist on caribs, avdun tesuva, at that point they repent. Meaning, it takes poverty, it takes difficulty, privation, in order for us to do tshuva. And Rabbi Akiva comments on it and says, Ya'a miskenusa livrate de Yaakov, ka'arka sumka bereisha desusya chiyura. Rabbi Akiva said, poverty is good for the daughter of Yaakov, like a red lace on the head of a white horse. In other words, it enhances the beauty. That's the statement that you see here in this Medrash. Rabbi Akiva seems to be saying, hey, Jews, poverty is good for you. More or less, that's his comment. It's a striking statement. I pair that with source number two. And for the sources in general, I'm going to be working with my English translations as opposed to the original Hebrew that's there on the sheet, just in the interests of time. Feel free, of course, to work with either one. But we're told in source number two, Rabbi Akiva instructed his son Rabbi Yoshua in seven matters. He said, my son, here are your instructions, my son. Do not sit and study at the peak of the city, where you can get distracted and disturbed by passersby. Do not live in a city led by Torah scholars, which I think is self-explanatory, but the idea being they're a little too busy in their studies and they don't get involved in the needs, the practical needs of the citizens. Do not enter your house suddenly and certainly your friend's house, right? You can intrude on somebody. That's rude. Make sure that you knock first. Even if it's your own house, you knock first. Do not let your feet be without shoes, okay? Don't go barefoot, Canadians. You should always make sure that you're wearing shoes. Shoes actually are very important in the Gemara as a matter of survival. Not having shoes is considered an abject form of poverty. It's actually really interesting because some say that this Rabbi Yoshua, who's the son of Rabbi Akiva, was known also as Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. And we have a story about him not having shoes, not wearing shoes. So that's an interesting thing in its own right. But he says, my son, you should always have shoes. And then he says, get up and eat early in the summer because of the sun. Get up and eat early in the winter because of the cold. He wants you to eat before that. Breakfast apparently is an important meal. And then he says, make your Shabbat like a weekday rather than need the support of others. And that's the line that's relevant for us here. He says, better that you should turn Shabbos into a regular day of the week in terms of your meals rather than need the support of others. And then he concludes, work in partnership with someone who is succeeding now. You see someone's doing well? Take advantage. Join the club. So said Rabbi Akiva to his son Rabbi Yoshua. And the point that I'm picking up on here is that he tells his son not to accept tzedakah, not to go looking for tzedakah, I should say. Better that, Shabbos should look like a Monday. Okay. So my problem here is that Rabbi Akiva looks awfully unsympathetic to the plight of the needy. He says, poverty, that's really good for you. Makes you beautiful. My son, if you need, don't go looking for tzedakah. Better that you should go hungry. Better that you shouldn't have nice stuff for Shabbos. And that sounds unsympathetic. And then I pair it up with source number three. Source number three, Avos D'Rabbi Nassan. Avos D'Rabbi Nassan is a rabbinical expansion of Pirkei Avot, published a few centuries after the Gemara, but quotes various sages who appear in the Talmud. And here, in source number three, they're talking about Rabbi Akiva. They said, he, Rabbi Akiva, did not pass away until he had tables of silver and gold. And he ascended to his bed with ladders of gold. His wife had tunics and an ear shell zahav. An ear shell zahav is an ornament, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, but it was some sort of crown or ornament with the city of Jerusalem portrayed in gold. So he had tables of silver and gold, ladders of gold to get into bed. His wife had tunics and had an ear shell zahav, this ornament. And then his students said, our master, you have embarrassed us with what you have made for her. To which Rabbi Akiva replied, she endured great pain with me for Torah. She went through an awful lot to get here. You better believe I'm giving her jewelry. But but leaving aside that comment for the moment, Rabbi Akiva possesses such wealth here, as described here. He's saying to the needy, you should not make use of tzedakah. Better to be impoverished. I feel like I've done the impossible in the opening few minutes. I've taken one of the most sympathetic figures in the entire rabbinic canon and made him seem horrible. That's a hard thing to do with Rabbi Akiva. So what I'd like to do is ask the question of what is it that Rabbi Akiva is recommending here? How does Rabbi Akiva end up this way? And in particular, when we know that Rabbi Akiva is a pauper for a very significant chunk of his life, all the way into middle age, Rabbi Akiva, we are told, dies at the age of 120. All the way into middle age, Rabbi Akiva is impoverished before coming into wealth. So I want to understand how it is that someone who had been needy, who had been on the receiving end, could espouse this sort of philosophy and what this should teach us about tzedakah and what this should teach us about reinvention. Now, one note. There are a lot of sources on these pages, right? Those who have downloaded the source sheet can see we got four pages here. Some of them I'm going to read aloud. Some of them I'm going to just refer to, and you can read them later, you know, yourselves. I've elected to make an argument based on a range of sources, and the sacrifice is that we're not going to be able to examine each one in depth. Each of these sources could be a session, could be a shiur unto itself, but it's not realistic. So what I want to do is sort of put these together as a package and hope that you enjoy the result as much as I do. Are we on the same page so far? We're good? Everyone understands the problem that we've set forward? Okay. Anyone having trouble downloading the source sheet? Oh, hopefully we're okay. All right. I much prefer being able to see people as opposed to sharing a screen, so that's why I'm doing it this way. All right. So before we can build some understanding of what Rabbi Akiva's approach was to tzedakah, we need to first understand the challenge of building any approach regarding Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is not like, lower profile sage where there's a story here, there's a story here, there's a story over here, and that's our source of information. That's not Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva has such a wealth of information about him, so many different passages, so many different quotes, that unfortunately not all of them agree with each other. And I'll show you what I mean. If you take a look at source number 4, actually, you know what? Before you take a look at source number 4, don't look at source number 4 yet. Take a look, please, at source number 7. This is the way to do it. Source number 7. I have a few questions there, which I'm going to throw out to you. First question there, the first bullet point in source number 7. How did Rabbi Akiva come to learn Torah? What caused him to come to learn Torah? Ah, Samoish says, right? This was a quote from last night, from Greg noted it as well. He saw water eroded a stone, and he was inspired and said, wow, well, Torah, water, you can erode my heart, also can make an impact on me. Any other answers for how Rabbi Akiva came to study Torah? Anyone hear anything else?
On the roof, he would listen from the roof.
Ooh, that's Hillel. Hillel is very comparable to Rabbi Akiva in a lot of different ways. So, Ralph, I'm with you on that. But I don't believe we have that story with Rabbi Akiva. Anyone know anything about a story involving his wife, Rachel? Does that ring a bell? So, we're going to come back and... One second. Elaine, what? Right, although that's not why he goes to learn. That's how he gets disowned. but Rachel, I thought this might be where you were going, Rachel insists, according to another version of the story, Rachel insists that he learn Torah as a stipulation. You want to marry me? This is what you have to do. Rose, was that what you were going to say? Yeah. So I'll ask you another question. In source number 7, I asked you, second bullet point, when did Rabbi Akiva go to learn? Was it before he married Rachel or after he married Rachel? Don't know. All right, we're going to see. The answer is both. It's quantum Rabbi Akiva. He did it before and he did it after. Was Rabbi Akiva with his family while he was learning? Or did he go off and seclude himself in the Beit Midrash?
He was sent away by his
Yeah, so Ralph says, as he say, it also, somebody, that part of my screen said it, that he, his wife sent him away. And yet, we're also gonna see another source that says, no, he's with his wife at the time, or at any rate, he's certainly with his children. The whole thing is gonna be very strange. Let's go back to source number 4. This is a Gemara in Nedarim. And again, I'm just sticking with my English translations here. Okay? And I'm going to put the link in the chat one more time for the source sheet since people keep joining, which is good. More people should join. But take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Akiva had Kiddushin with the daughter of Kalba Savua. We know that in Jewish law, marriage has two parts. The first ritual is Kiddushin, where he gives her the ring, and there is a bracha to be said, and we do it with a cup of wine as well. And then, separately, there's Nisuin, which is the 7 blessings said under the chuppah. So, initially, Rabbi Akiva had Kiddushin with the daughter of Kalba Savua. Kalba Savua is a very wealthy man. The Gemara in Gittin says he was called Kalba Savua because what? What does Kalba Savua mean? I'm sorry?
satisfied cat, you know.
A satisfied dog.
Dog.
A full dog.
Well, a
okay, right.
Correct.
It's a female dog.
It's actually a male. It's Aramaic. It's a male dog. In Hebrew, it would be a female. But the Gemara in Gittin says anybody who came into his house starving would leave full, like this Kalba Savua. So Kalba Savua is the father-in-law. Well, he hears about the Kiddushin and he's not a fan. He vowed she would not benefit from his property. And later we find out it's because Rabbi Akiva is ignorant. She went and married him anyway. So there, Dad. Because disowning always works. Had he not seen any movies or any? Okay. In the fall, they slept in the straw storage area, and she picked straw from his beard. He told her, if I had it, I would give you a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, this ornament of gold. Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, you're familiar with the song. But I would give you this gold ornament that depicts Yerushalayim if I only had it. So along comes Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, and says, I'm going to make them feel better about their poverty. Eliyahu came and appeared as a person and called at the gate, saying, give me a little straw, for my wife has given birth, and we have nothing on which she could lie. Rabbi Akiva told his wife, see, this man even lacks straw. We're not so bad off. We at least have straw on which we could lie. She said to him, go learn in yeshiva. He went before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua for 12 years. After 12 years were complete, he came home. He heard from behind his house a wicked person saying to his wife, your father has done well to you. First, Rabbi Akiva is not like you. He's not of your standing. He's not from your part of society. We're going to find out later what that means. And second, he left you a living widow all these years. He went off to yeshiva. He's been gone. She replied, if he would listen to me, he would learn for another 12 years. And Rabbi Akiva hears this. So Rabbi Akiva said, since she's permitted me, I'm going to turn around and go back to yeshiva, apparently without even going to the house. He went back and learned for another 12 years, and then he arrived home with 24,000 pairs of students, and there's a whole story to be told about the reunion, which I'm not going to get into right now. But in this version of the story, Rabbi Akiva is betrothed, or not, it's stronger than betrothed, has partial marriage to the daughter of Kalba Savua. She'll be named Rachel later in another source we're going to see. Then her father disowns them. Then they get fully married. They are living together as husband and wife. And then she says, I want you to go learn in yeshiva. And he goes off to learn 12 years and then another 12 years. Now take a look at source number 5, please. Source number 5, you can see the English at the top of the next slide. Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd for Ben Kalba Savua. His daughter saw Rabbi Akiva was tsanua. Tsanua implies modesty, privacy, not seeking the spotlight. And he was good. And she asked him, if I would accept Kiddushin from you, would you go to yeshiva? So now it's a stipulation. You want to marry me? You have to go learn. He replied, yes. They held Kiddushin secretly, and she sent him to yeshiva. Nonetheless, nothing's going to stay secret. Her father heard, evicted her from his home, and vowed she could not benefit from his property. So common element in the two stories, poverty, right? Disowning. Rabbi Akiva went and sat in yeshiva for 12 years, and then once again, he comes back after 12 years, he hears somebody, in this version it's an elderly man, saying this to her, again, how long are you going to remain a living widow? And she says, I wish you would go another 12 years, and so he said, okay, I guess I will. But when he comes back, in this version of the story, Kalba Savua says, I heard a great man came to the city. I'm going to go get my vow repealed. And it turns out he's going to Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva repeals the vow on the basis of the fact that the vow was made because he thought his son-in-law was not going to be learned. So at that point, the vow is repealed and he gives Rabbi Akiva half his assets. That's your second story. We already see some differences. In source number 5, learning in yeshiva is a prerequisite for marrying. In source number 4, they were actually married together before she ever sent him off to yeshiva. Now take a look at source number 6. Source number 6 is from Avot Rabbi Natan, which we used before. We already saw Avot Rabbi Natan in source number 3. it tells us how Rabbi Akiva came to learn. And here Moish will be happy because we're going to give his version of how Rabbi Akiva came to learn. What was Rabbi Akiva's beginning? They said he was 40 years old. He had not learned at all. Once he was standing by a well and he asked, "Who carved this stone?" And they told him, "The water which continually falls upon it daily." And they said to him, "Akiva, don't you know the verse in Job?" Because everybody knows Job. "Stones were eroded by water." I don't know why they assume he should know a verse in Job. Seriously. It's chapter 14, too. Most people give up after chapter 2. Fine. "You should know stones were eroded by water." Immediately, Rabbi Akiva drew a logical inference for himself. If the soft, the water, can carve the hard, the stone, then how much more so could words of Torah, which are hard as iron, carve my heart of flesh and blood? Immediately, Rabbi Akiva sought to study Torah. He says, "I can learn." He and his son went and sat by the school teachers. Now he has a kid. We didn't have that in the first two versions. And he said, "My master, teach me Torah." Rabbi Akiva gripped the top of the board, you know, the board on which they would write. And his son gripped the other end of the board, and there's this whole story about how he learned. If you come back on Wednesday evening to the session I'm going to do then, we're going to talk about what that learning process was. That will matter for our discussion then. Each day, Rabbi Akiva would bring a bundle of wood. Half he would sell to support himself. The other half he would use for his own needs. His neighbors complained, saying to him, "Akiva, you have destroyed us with smoke. Sell the wood to us, purchase oil with the money, and study by the light of a lamp." Right? Climate issues. They said, "You're burning fossil fuels here. The smoke is polluting our atmosphere. Use oil instead. It's clean." Clean natural gas, as the commercial goes. We want you to use oil. Rabbi Akiva says, "No, I need the wood." He replied, "I meet many needs with the wood. I use part to study, part to warm myself, and part on which to sleep. Go try to sleep on oil. That's not going to work. I need this wood. Sorry." Rabbi Akiva, the passage here says, the narrator speaking, "Rabbi Akiva will make paupers liable for judgment," meaning in heaven. "For when they are asked, 'Why did you not learn Torah?' and they reply, 'Because we were poor,' they will be told, 'Rabbi Akiva was exceptionally poor and destitute. He learned.' And when they say, 'We had children,' they will be told, 'Rabbi Akiva had sons and daughters.'" So he's got a lot of kids while this is going on. "But they will say, 'It's because of the merit of his wife, Rachel.' Sure, because he had Rachel as a wife. If I had a wife like that, I'd also learn." Oh boy. Rabbi Akiva went to study Torah when he was 40 years old. After 13 years, he taught Torah publicly. Okay. So what I'm trying to show you here, and I spent a good chunk of time on it because I think it's important, is that the different versions of the story veer from each other somewhat in terms of what exactly it was that drove Rabbi Akiva to learn, in terms of whether he was married before he went to learn, was not married before he went to learn, did he have a child when he went to learn. These things are unclear. However, we have certain common denominators. Specifically, he starts out life with little money and low social standing. He comes to learning late, and then he learns for a long period of time, and he becomes a leading sage, and as we'll see, he also becomes wealthy. So we can use these and other early sources to gain an understanding of who Rabbi Akiva was and what he can teach us. We're all... Okay? All right. So let's look at Rabbi Akiva's narrative. Let's see what we can build here. First of all, we've already seen he started out as a pauper. He is a shepherd taking care of the animals of Kalba Savua. We saw that in source number 4 and in source number 5. Maybe as a shepherd he could make a living, but then he got fired for marrying the daughter of Kalba Savua. That apparently was not supposed to happen. So that was bad. They were disowned. So now they're sleeping on straw, assuming they are together, as per at least one of the passages. We also see him chopping wood and selling the wood as a way to make a living, right? That's something that other sages did as well. Definitely not a lucrative business, though. There's one other data point that we have about Rabbi Akiva and his livelihood. And that's the passage I brought you in source number 8. This is a passage which I am not going to read in full. You can see that it's long, but I wanted you to have it. It's a beautiful story. The Talmud uses this story to illustrate the principle of dan lekaf zechut. What does dan lekaf zechut mean? Right, giving people the benefit of the doubt, literally judging people favorably. The idea of dan lekaf zechut is if you see somebody doing something and you're not sure why they're doing it, particularly in the event that it in some way harms you, assume the best of them. So the Talmud tells a story of a certain laborer who worked for somebody for 3 years. It's Erev Yom Kippur. He wants to go home and bring something to his family. Yom Kippur is coming. Sukkot is coming. And he asks for his wages. And the boss tells him, I don't have anything to give you. He says, he asks for cash. I don't have any cash. Produce. I don't have any land. I don't have any. An animal. I don't have that either. Pillows, cushions, nothing. The worker goes home depressed and upset. After Sukkot is over, the employer comes to him and brings him his salary and brings him donkey loads loaded down with a feast. And he says, what did you think of me when I told you I didn't have any of these things? When you asked for your wages and I said I don't have any money, what did you think? And the worker says, I assumed that you found some kind of an investment. You found merchandise to invest in. And what about the animal? I suspected you had rented out your animals. And the land? I suspected you hired out the land to somebody who was going to work it. And the produce? I thought maybe you hadn't tithed it yet. And the pillows and the cushions? Maybe you had dedicated it to the temple. And sure enough, the fellow says, the employer says, all of that is exactly right. So it was. And he gives a story, which I'm not going to go into right now. All of this is in source number 8 to explain. And he says, you judged me for merit, so too God should judge you for merit. Now, there's no name mentioned for who the worker was here. However, in the Gaonic literature, I'm jumping ahead to the 8th century, the She'iltot of Rav Achoy, maybe the 9th century, we are told that the laborer was actually Rabbi Akiva. So that means that we have 3 different jobs for Rabbi Akiva. He's a shepherd. He is a wood gatherer and seller, chopper perhaps. And he's also a laborer, common laborer. So he begins as somebody who has to work. He clearly knows what it means to work. And then he becomes wealthy. And here I refer you to source number 9. I'm going a little quickly through the sources. Hopefully, though, it's still okay. The questions or comments before this? Okay. So in source number 9, we find out how the tide turns for Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva became wealthy from 6 sources. The first source, Kalba Savua, his father-in-law, once the father-in-law came around. Second, the ram of a boat. On every boat, they would make a sort of treasure chest. It was like for good luck. And it was in the shape of a ram's head. Why a ram's head? I don't know. It seemed like calls to mind like Viking ships or something where you'd put it on the front. I don't know. But it was a box of some kind. And once they left it on the shore by accident and Rabbi Akiva came along and he found it on the shore. So he got rich. Third, another chest. He invested 4 zuz with sailors. 4 zuz. How much is 4 zuz worth? 2 young goats, right? Ostensibly, Chad Gadya, right? 2 young goats. So find out what a yearling goat costs. 2 of those. I had a friend when I was in Pennsylvania who went to a fair to find out how much it cost to buy a young goat. So he could then know, like, what a zuz was actually supposed to be. But in any case.
The ksuna says 200.
Ksuna is 200 zuz. That's a lot of goats. That's true. So the story here with this chest was that once he gave sailors 4 zuz, and he said to them, you know, go buy something for me with it. That's his way of investing. They didn't find anything, but they found a chest along the shore, different from the one that we just read about. And they brought it back and they said to him, you know what? Wait on it. We'll find something else. But he opened it up and he found that it was full of coins from a boat that had sunk and they had put all their merchandise in the chest. So now he struck it rich once again. Rabbi Akiva should buy lottery tickets and just hand them out because that's the way things work here. The fourth story was the story of a matron. This is a great story. Rabbeinu Nissim, in his commentary on the Talmud, explains what the matron story was. The story was that a matron, apparently a Roman matron, had lent money to Rabbi Akiva. And when the time came and the debt was due, he was ill, and he couldn't pay back the debt. So she went to the sea, stood by the water, and declared to God, you know, I lent money to this scholar, Rabbi Akiva, and now he can't pay me back because he's ill. And sure enough, at the same time, the Roman consul's daughter throws a box containing jewelry and all sorts of stuff into the sea. That washes up. The matron finds it. And the matron gives Rabbi Akiva the surplus over and above what he owed for the debt. That's the story of the matron. The fifth one is the wife of Turnus Rufus. I alluded to her in the session last night. The story with the wife of Turnus Rufus, to make a long story short, is Turnus Rufus was the Roman consul. We're going to talk about him in a little bit. He was a rival of Rabbi Akiva. He was forever causing Rabbi Akiva trouble. Well, once he arranged for his wife to attempt to seduce Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was not seducible. And she was so impressed, make a long story short, she ended up marrying Rabbi Akiva, converting to Judaism and marrying Rabbi Akiva. Go figure. So that brings him additional wealth. Unclear whether this is while Rachel was still alive or not. I will say that we do not know of any case in the Talmud that clearly presents a polygamous sage. We have the opposite idea. We don't find any actual cases of a polygamous sage, which leads me to assume that this was actually two wives in sequence rather than simultaneous. And then finally, the story of Ketia Bar Shalom, who was a Roman officer who saved the Jews from a decree of persecution, but was sentenced to death, and he gave all his wealth to Rabbi Akiva. That's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So Rabbi Akiva starts out broke. Works really, really hard, doesn't make any money from that, and then stuff just falls into his lap, right? He just gets money, whether from Kalba Savua and the wife of Turnus Rufus, Akitia Bar Shalom, or the ocean, the sea, water, chests, treasure chests just wash up on the shore for him. It's really interesting here. What's the common denominator among these six sources of wealth? What's the common denominator?
Pure accident.
Accident? Okay. Ralph says accident. Ricky?
No work for it.
He doesn't ask for it.
He doesn't ask for it, Ricky says. Moish says no work required. It's really striking, isn't it? He doesn't go looking for it, right? Like Ricky said, he doesn't go looking for it. The most he does is invest four zuz with the sailors. That's it. And in at least three of the events, it's entirely, totally, divinely orchestrated, without any human being involved in directly providing it to Rabbi Akiva. The box is left on the shore. The box is dropped into the sea. And lo and behold, he's got it. And Rabbi Akiva becomes wealthy. So what we know here, what we can assert, is that he starts out poor, works really hard, doesn't make any money on it, but then he becomes wealthy in all these other ways. How does Rabbi Akiva spend his money? Well, we know at least one thing. What did we say? On his wife. He gets her the gold ornament as well as the tunics. In source number 10, I brought you a passage in the Talmud which talks about what the city of gold was that Rabbi Akiva made for his wife. It was, according to Rashi, it was a round brooch. Rav Avadya Bar Tanura says it was an ornament in the shape of the city of Jerusalem. I assume that means like the skyline or something. Rabbeinu Nissim says it was Jerusalem drawn on a plate of gold. Another suggests that it's a crown. And in addition to that, we saw that he gave her tunics as well. Plus, he had his own gold and silver furniture, which in the Talmud represents honor. I don't know what it's like to have gold and silver furniture. I'm not sure that it's really enjoyable. Right? I mean, you try sitting on a couch like that. That's not so enjoyable. Try falling asleep on a bed that's made out of that. I don't think it actually works so well.
You get a feather. You get a feather mattress and you sleep.
But if you have a feather mattress, then who cares that the bed is made of gold? Make the bed out of wood. What good is it? The answer really is that if you look in the Talmud in a few other places, and I was going to bring him on here, and I figured I had enough sources on the source sheet, but you can look at the Gemara in Sukkah, Nun Aleph, Kiddushin Ayin Vav, a few others, we find them describing having gold thrones and gold furniture as something of aristocracy. It shows that you've gained standing, that you have stature. There's actually a passage in Yevamos involving this also that I'm going to use, God willing, on Wednesday. So for those who come back on Wednesday evening, we'll see Rabbi Akiva in another situation sitting on a bed of gold. But what we see here is, yes, Rabbi Akiva has gratitude to his wife, Rachel. And I skipped in the Talmudic passage the part where he tells his students, Shali v'shalachem shalahu. All that you have and all that I have, all the learning and all the Torah really belongs to her. It owes to her. There's that. But Rabbi Akiva also engages in tzedakah. Rabbi Akiva is a giver, and he is somebody also who teaches others to give. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 11 as an example of this. It's talking... Sorry?
Rabbi, yeah. Is he not obligated to give a tenth of his earnings?
Tenth of income, yeah, absolutely. But we're going to see more than that here. We're going to see a lot more. The passage here in source number 11, in context, is dealing with the question of what it is that one is allowed to transport on Shabbat. That's what it's dealing with in context. The rule is that you violate Shabbat if you transport things outside in a public domain. And for something to be considered significant in terms of transport, it has to be something that people would actually use. And this is where you get the following passage. Source number 11. If someone owes 1,000 mana, you have somebody who's a borrower. He owes 1,000 mana. Mana is a unit of currency. And he's wearing fancy clothing that's worth 100 mana. So what do? We remove the fancy clothing, remove that from him, and clothe him in something that's more suitable. So that way we'll take the 100 mana clothing and use that as part of payment of his debt. That's what's supposed to happen. However, it was taught in the name of Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva, all Israel is worthy of such fancy clothing. Meaning, we are supposed to have that level. That's the honor that is due. And therefore, when it comes to tzedakah, that's the standard. No matter how impoverished one is, you're supposed to try to support them to a high level. Not only that, but Rabbi Akiva was known as Yadan Shel Aniyim. He was the hand of the poor, meaning he was a tzedakah collector on their behalf. So I brought you an example in source number 12, a Mishnah in Maaser Sheni, which has the elders traveling by boat, and Rabbi Gamliel wants to tithe the produce that he has with him. And he says, it's produce that he doesn't have with him on the boat. So he says, the tenth that I'm going to separate for the needy is given to Rabbi Akiva. Why Rabbi Akiva? The Talmud explains, because he was the arm of the needy. He was known as the tzedakah collector. He was a very effective tzedakah collector. Take a look at source number 13 from Masechet Kala, which is an added tractate to the Talmud. Look at this story. Everybody is going to love this story except Rabbi Tarfon. Watch this. They said about Rabbi Tarfon that he was very wealthy, and he didn't give to the needy in an appropriate way for what he had and who he was. Now, Rabbi Tarfon was a great sage. I added the word appropriately because we know he gave something. He just wasn't giving what Rabbi Akiva perhaps felt he should give. Once, Akiva, as he's named there, no rabbi there, once Akiva found him and said to him, "My master, would you like me to purchase a city or two for you?" Apparently Rabbi Tarfon plays in the big leagues. He says, "If you want, I could buy you a city or two." And he said, "Yes." Immediately Rabbi Tarfon stood up and gave him 4,000 gold dinar. Hefty investment. Rabbi Akiva took them and distributed them to the needy. After some time, Rabbi Tarfon found him and said to him, "Akiva, where are the cities you purchased for me?" He took him by the hand, and he brought him to the Beit Midrash, and he brought it to Hillim, and put it in front of them. And they read along until they reached the following verse, "Pizar Natan Le'Evyonim, he scattered funds for the needy, his righteousness stands forever, his pride will be elevated in honor." In other words, somebody who scatters his funds for the needy is somebody who has truly attained. His righteousness stands forever, his keren, his pride will be elevated in honor. And Rabbi Tarfon took the hint. He stood and he kissed him on the head. So Rabbi Akiva redirected the funds. By the way, do not try this at home. But Rabbi Akiva directed the funds that were given to him for investment to invest them in tzedakah. Interestingly, just as a parenthetical note, Rabbi Akiva's daughter learned the lesson, right? Anybody know the story of Rabbi Akiva's daughter on her wedding day?
With the pin.
With the pin, yes, that story. Right? Rabbi Akiva was told by somebody, some astrologer of some kind, that his daughter was going to die on her wedding day. And he didn't want her to get married off. But ultimately, she gets married off. And she comes back from the celebration. And she takes off her hairpin and she sticks it in the wall. And the next day, she finds that it has pierced a snake through the eye on the wall. And they ask her, "What in the world was that about?" And she says, "I don't know." And they say, "Well, can you tell us what happened yesterday? Something." And she says, "Well, everybody was involved in getting ready for the wedding. And nobody heard this needy person on the street who was asking for support. So I went and gave him some tzedakah." And so they said, "Tzedakah tatzil mimavet. Tzedakah saves from death." She learned that value of giving tzedakah. There's more to his daughter. There's a whole other piece of Torah about his daughter. But now that we know more about Rabbi Akiva, and I realize I'm rushing through all of this material, and yet it's already 8:15. But tell me something. Can we figure out what Rabbi Akiva meant, based on what we've said so far, when he said that poverty is beautiful? When he said that his son should not take tzedakah? Like, how do I put all of these pieces together? What kind of a picture can we develop of Rabbi Akiva to understand how, on the one hand, he's benevolent. He's giving tzedakah. He's taking funds and turning them to tzedakah. He's a public tzedakah collector. And yet he's saying to his kid, "Don't look for tzedakah." And yet he's saying, "Poverty is beautiful." Ricky.
I think he's trying to say that if you are a righteous person, if you do the right things, and you don't ask for it, it will come to you.
Things will just come to you.
Well, just adapt to him. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're asking for tzedakah, you're really not working yourself. You're really not bettering yourself on your own.
Right. Okay. That's one thought. I want to come back to that. Anything in addition? Claudette.
Is he saying poverty is beautiful because it gives the other person the opportunity to serve the gift?
Interesting. Interesting. And Ralph concurs.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So I think that is related, not directly, but indirectly, but we're going to see something that I think supports that idea. So hold that thought. We have two thoughts now to hold on to. We have Ricky's idea that it's going to come to you, and Claudette's idea that the needy are going to be supported for the sake of the donor, the person who is giving to them. That's the beauty of it. So let's see the following. When I started, yes, Janine.
Maybe that poverty may teach us a lesson that we wouldn't
have if we were always, we always had whatever we needed. We would not learn that lesson.
Interesting. So there's something to learn from going through it. Right. I mean, certainly, if anybody can say that, it's Rabbi Akiva, because he went through the ringer, right? For the first 40 years of his life, before learning, and even afterwards, depending on which of these stories we take, there's some period of time after that where he's impoverished and hardworking and all of those things. So I definitely, definitely concede that would be a theme here. See, when we started the Shavua Tone planning, I sat down and said, what are the changes Rabbi Akiva goes through in his life? And one of them was this rags-to-riches story, and I thought it must be reinvention. But the more I looked at the sources, and the more I tried to see a narrative here, the more I realized that Rabbi Akiva, in this sense, isn't truly reinventing. And I apologize, because it's under the banner of reinvention, but I have to tell it the way I see it. Rabbi Akiva takes the philosophy that he had when he was broke and applies the same philosophy to his new circumstance of wealth. His philosophy, in a word, and this is something that Ricky was saying, is emunah. He is all about emunah. Belief, faith. Accept what God sends your way and don't look for people to send something your way. He was working. He was, to use the term that we popularly use for this in Hebrew, he was mishtadel. He did hishtadlus. He worked. He held at least 3 different jobs. And if you think about him later in life, he supports the Bar Kokhba revolt, a topic that Rabbi Metzger is going to address, God willing, on Thursday evening. But Rabbi Akiva is all about accepting what God gives you. Rabbi Akiva comes to that from his Rebbe. He had a few different Rebbeim. But as I noted in source number 14, Rabbi Akiva had a particular mentor, Nachum Ish Gamzu. Now, Nachum Ish Gamzu gets the name Gamzu. He's also known as Nachum Ha'amsuni. But that becomes Gamzu because he used to say what phrase? What was his catchphrase? Gamzu Latova. This is also for the best. Rabbi Akiva apprenticed to him for 22 years, and he absorbed the ideology that everything that happens is for the best. Take a look at source number 15. Classic story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva's traveling. I'm paraphrasing, but you can see the text in number 15. Rabbi Akiva's traveling. He arrives at a town. He tries to find a place to stay, but they're not going to let him stay anywhere. I don't know what town this was, but they didn't let him stay. I don't know who does that to Rabbi Akiva, but fine. He said, all that God does is for the good. He goes to sleep outside of the town. He has a rooster, a donkey, and a lamp with him. I don't know. It sounds like a joke a little bit, right? A tana, a rooster, a lamp, and a donkey are traveling on the... nonetheless, I guess there was no bar. So they went and stayed outside of the town. Wind comes and blows out the lamp. A cat comes and eats the rooster. A lion comes and eats the donkey. And he said, all that God does is for the good. And that night, armed men came and looted the town. Had he had the donkey, they would have heard the donkey. Had they had the rooster, they would have heard the rooster. Had he had a lamp, they would have seen the lamp. So he said, I told you, all that God does is for the good. That's how I survived. That's Rabbi Akiva. And perhaps the ultimate example of emunah for Rabbi Akiva is when the Romans execute him. Right? The Romans are raking his skin with iron combs, and they get to the spot with the tefillin, and he says, Shema Yisrael. And in source number 16, his students said to him, still? And his answer to them is what you see here in number 16. He says, my whole life I was pained by this verse, which says you're supposed to love God b'chol nafshecha, with your entire life, even if he takes your life. I said, when will this come to my hand and I will fulfill it? Now that it's come to my hand, shall I not fulfill it? He says, down to the end, he trusts in God. That's Rabbi Akiva's identity, and not just for himself, but for the Jewish people as a whole. The classic story in source number 17, in which Rabbi Akiva and the sages are traveling on the road, and they hear the sounds of the Romans, and they're celebrating, and their noise, And it's contrasted with the ruins in Jerusalem. And the sages are crying, and Rabbi Akiva is laughing, and he sees the foxes on the Temple Mount. That whole story, the Gemara at the end of Makos. That's what I brought you here, number 17. Rabbi Akiva laughs. He has faith. Just like this came true, this prophecy of destruction came true, so too the prophecies of hope will come true. Rabbi Akiva's philosophy seen in these sources is one of emunah, is one of faith. And emunah was his approach to pursuing tzedakah for himself. He did not seek help from human beings. He became wealthy not by asking, but by receiving what God arranged. Mind you, he accepts it. He doesn't turn it away. He didn't say no, but he doesn't go looking for it. As a matter of fact, the Maharsha, a commentator to the Talmud, says that if you look right before the story of Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara in Nedarim that we read before, it follows a passage about the sage Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda was sent a gift of a cloak, and he did not accept it. He didn't want to accept support. Rabbi Akiva accepts support, but he won't ask for it. He won't seek that support. That's his philosophy. It is reinforced by the Rebbeim who he had. It was reinforced by Nachum Ish Gamzu. It was reinforced also in source number 19. Rabbi Akiva asked the sage Rabbi Nechunya the Great, how did you live so long? And one of the points that Rabbi Nechunya taught him was, I never took gifts. And he learned it from another Rebbe of his, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and now I'm really rushing, in source number 20, who was also known for renouncing property. It's not asceticism, though. It's not, I don't want anything. He's willing to accept the wealth that comes his way. He has the gold furniture. But he has a belief that it's coming from God. And now we can understand his advice to the needy about tzedakah. Rabbi Akiva is a big believer in philanthropy. He believes that he should give. He believes that everybody should give. And if you're not willing to give, he's going to take your money under false pretenses and use it for tzedakah too. That's what he did. We saw it. He did it to Rabbi Tarfon. However, and this is Claudette's idea that she mentioned, he believes that the purpose of tzedakah is not for the recipient. The purpose of tzedakah is for the giver. It's for the benefactor. You'll be better off, is his point. Take a look at source number 21. Classic. Turnus Rufus, who was married to that woman before Rabbi Akiva was, right? Turnus Rufus asked Rabbi Akiva, if your God loves the needy, why doesn't he take care of them? To which Rabbi Akiva responds, so that we, the givers, should be saved from Gehenna through them. It's for us to have merit. Now, that sounds unsympathetic to the needy, like you exist so that I can get a mitzvah, right? But it's not what it is. He does everything he can to make sure that they will have what they need. But it's a commitment to a faith that he wishes to share. He doesn't believe in seeking tzedakah from human beings. And fascinatingly, he prioritizes the benefit to the donor over the benefit to the recipient. I'll show you what I mean. Flip the last page, source number 22, and then we'll do a summary. Two sources. First of all, one source, number 22, has Rabbi Akiva keeping Rabbi Yeshevav from spending too much money on tzedakah. I don't want you spending more than 20%. I don't want you going broke trying to give. Right? The potential recipients are there with their hands out. But he says, you have to preserve yourself. That's number one. And then number two, classic ethical debate. You have money to give to tzedakah. Let's say you had a good year, you have $100,000 that you can give to tzedakah. Is it better for you to give $100,000 to one person, or let's say two gifts of $50,000? Or is it better for you to say, I'm going to give $1,100 gifts? Which is better?
$1,100.
Izzy says $1,100 gifts. How do you know? Bingo. Excellent. Rabbi Akiva says in a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Hakol lefi rov hama'aseh. It's all according to how many times you perform the deed. And the Rambam, Maimonides, in source number 23, explains what Rabbi Akiva is saying. He says, you need practice. You have to give frequently. And so he says, if you give 1,000 dinar to one recipient, you're not going to achieve the trait of generosity. As opposed to if you give 1,000 different gifts of one dinar, giving each one generously, then you're going to learn to be a generous person. Now, that's all well and good from the donor side, but the recipient, you know, would like to be the one who gets lucky and gets 1,000 dinar. But again, we're prioritizing the donor's benefit. The recipient, God's going to take care of them. It's the donor we're worried about. And Rabbi Akiva has the credibility to give that advice because he lived that life. He did it. He's not just talking. He was that needy person. He was the person on the receiving end. So, to summarize, I brought you 5 review questions at the end. What was Rabbi Akiva's philosophy about money when he was needy? He worked. He did not look for support from others, but he did accept. How did Rabbi Akiva become wealthy? Found items from the sea, gifts from Kalba Savua, the wife of Turnus Rufus. When he became wealthy, what was his attitude to giving tzedakah? He gave, and he pushed other people to give as well. When he became wealthy, his advice about receiving tzedakah was better to trust in God. And how did Rabbi Akiva's advice regarding receiving tzedakah relate to his philosophy regarding his own suffering? It all came back to one thought. Gamzu letova, this is also for the good, and emuna, which he had learned from his mentors. So as I said before, at first I thought this was going to have to be reinvention. When I just looked at Rabbi Akiva, and he's a pauper, and he becomes wealthy, now he has to do something differently. But then I realized he actually maintained his old ideals in a new scenario. And I think that also carries a great lesson for us. In a new circumstance, and we've spent the last, whatever it is, 15 months in a new circumstance, and God willing, this ends, we'll be in another new circumstance. In a new circumstance, we don't throw out the old for the sake of throwing out the old. That which worked for us before may remain useful for us now, and we should value it. I think that's very true for the post-pandemic world as well. I think that's a valuable lesson in terms of the way we approach the new. Ask ourselves what worked for us before, and therefore ought to be kept. Also, as we saw in Avot Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Akiva is held up as a model for the needy because he persisted in his trust in God when he was suffering. He was mishtadel, he worked, but he kept that trust. So may we merit to develop and keep that trust as well. I apologize again for being very quick with this and racing through a lot of sources. I hope that it was still somewhat clear. I'm going to take questions, but for those who planned on an hour, we somehow or other got that in an hour. Thank you very, very much. And remember, we do this every evening at 7:30 this week and then on Friday at 5 o'clock. And again, if you're not on the email list for classes and programs and you want to be, send me a note in the chat. I will be glad to add you. Thank you very, very much. Yes, Claudette.
I have a question.
Thank you. Yes, Claudette.
Rabbi Akiva was one of the rabbis that went down to Navne after the destruction of the temple, right?
So, yeah.